Ever feel like no matter how hard you work, you just can't seem to get ahead? Well, there's a good explanation for that, but it's a maddening one. The government intentionally and dramatically underreports the true cost of living. And it's this fake low number that most employers use when setting the wages they pay. So your paycheck isn't growing nearly as fast as it needs to in order to keep up with inflation.
People who are middle income and lower income, people who go to work and get raises, their raises are based on the CPI. So you have people who are working their tails off, paying taxes, doing everything right, but they're getting increases that are keeping them from actually making any money. In fact, they're losing purchasing power every single year.
Hello and welcome to Peak Prosperity. This is Peak Prosperity co-founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you back for another week of making sense of money and the markets. And this week we welcome Ed Butowski to the program. Ed spent his career in wealth management, first working for big investment banks like Morgan Stanley and Bear Stearns, and eventually founding his own firm, Chapwood Investments LLC, where he publishes the much known and respected Chapwood Index, which tracks the true cost of living across America. And that's what we're going to be focusing on in today's discussion with him. Ed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Adam.
All right, Ed. So we're going to get into the cost of living and the Chapwood Index and all that. But before we do, I just want to start with a general question for you, which is, what is your assessment of the current state of today's economy and financial markets?
Yeah, I'm happy you're asking that question. I was just doing some studying on the overall market valuation. And no matter what metric you look at, if you do any kind of regression analysis, the market is very expensive. And all you have to do is look at expected earnings growth and what the PE is. If you look backwards at the PE for 2020, you're looking at a price earnings multiple of 36. Right now, you're looking at a forward price earnings multiple of about 23. So you would have to have 23% earnings growth over last year to justify the valuation of the market. And you don't have the GDP growth that you need either. I mean, you know, we're looking at this next quarter GDP growth being, you know, somewhere around 5 or 6%. But, you know, that has to be every single quarter to support, you know, what we think is going to be growth in the S&P 500 companies. But you also have to remember that 44% of the earnings growth for the S&P 500 companies come from outside the United States. So you have to take a look at the rest of the world, and the rest of the world isn't growing that fast. I mean, we are basically in a huge bubble.
All right. So we've had many, many guests on this program over the past year who have echoed a lot of what you said, Ed, but I always just like to give our guests the ability to, you know, give their own unvarnished opinion before I introduce any of that history or bias here. So sounds like you feel, you know, look at the market somewhat similarly to we do, where you look at the underlying economic growth. And yes, actually, GDP growth is likely to be, you know, pretty decent this quarter, but we got to remember we're coming off of a year where GDP was actually grew negatively for the year, given the pandemic. So we're looking at a high asset price, high asset prices. You use the term bubble. Let's now kind of go over into the cost of living. I think a lot of what we're going to talk about are trends that well preceded the coronavirus, but certainly the trillions of fiscal and monetary stimulus that are likely contributing to this asset price bubble you're talking about, I'm going to guess, based on your read of the data, has probably made consumer price inflation worse because that money begins to trickle into the real world and push the prices of real things up. So before we get into the details of that, though, let's do a little bit of context setting and history here for folks. Can you tell us why you constructed the Chapwood Index, and can you tell us sort of how it's calculated?
Well, so the Chapwood Index was a dream of mine, or it came about because my mother, when one day I had gone home and my mother had said something about my father not adjusting her alimony for cola. And I didn't know what cola was. I thought she drank Tab. That's all I knew was was that. So then she, you know, she told me, she says, no, cost of living adjustment. And I thought, my goodness, I'd never even heard of that. That's, it'll tell you the kind of training that I had early on. And then I went and started researching about the cost of living adjustment. And I came across a guy named Albert Singlinger in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. And he started calculating the real cost of living increase starting in 1983 and showed how it was being manipulated by the government. And then it, then eventually, at some point, Albert Singlinger passed away. And I found a guy named John Williams with shadowstatistics.com. And he was doing the real cost of living increase, but doing without all the manipulation that the government has played games with. And remember, the government wants you to have smaller transfer payments, that's Social Security payments and benefits of any kind. And so they do everything they can to make that number seem lower. So then what really got to me was, why aren't we doing this city by city? Because every single city has a different cost of living increase. So it's not the cost of living, it's the increase that kills people. Because you can get a, you can get comfortable with your cost of living, but if your cost of living increases 10% and you're only getting a raise of 4%, you know, only takes, you know, 4 years for you to be 24% behind. And that's what really got me to the point where I started calculating the real cost of living increase for the top 50 cities around the country.
All right. And okay, so you talked about how the government statistics are very likely, you know, manipulated to look low, because then the government doesn't need to pay as much on a going forward basis, right? Social Security payments grow at a slower rate if they use a slower COLA, as you're mentioning. And the main metric that the government releases every month, that's sort of how it reports price inflation, is the CPI, Consumer Price Inflation Index. So that right now is, since the great financial crisis, it's largely been under 2% annual CPI. We saw, what, I think 1.4 in January, that was adjusted to 1.7 in February. So it's poking up a little bit. But how does that compare to the average rates in the Chapman Index?
Well, the average rate in the Chapman Index is about 10%, which sounds outrageous to people when they first hear that, because they're comparing it to the government CPI. But if you start to really think about what, you know, that your food is not included in the CPI, insurance is not included in the CPI, taxes are not included in the CPI, and you start really looking at how they evaluate what the CPI is, it doesn't take you a long time to get to the point where you realize that it is about 10%. In California, you're looking at, in Oakland, you're looking at about 12%. Long Beach, you're looking at 11%. Los Angeles, you're looking at 12%. And Chicago, you're looking at about 11%. New York, you're looking at 11%. So, you know, and by the way, those are blue states, because a lot of taxes are increased there, and those taxes are trickled down to the end consumer. So eventually it, you know, the cost for you to go and get, I mean, I kind of kid around a little bit, but with a bagel, if you got a bagel every single day, every morning, the cost of a bagel goes up about 15 to 18 cents every single year. Well, that's $53 more a year that you're paying in just a bagel. I mean, it's when you start to really look at all the different cost of living increases that are not calculated in the CPI.
Great. All right. So here's where I really want to roll up my sleeves and get into it. And by the way, I live in one of those blue states. I'm in Northern California, you know, about an hour and a half from Oakland. So I can attest that 11%, 12% range feels a lot more realistic than versus what the government's, you know, published CPI is, at least for where I'm living.
But by the way, let me add one thing. What really kills me about this is the negative unintended consequences of this. And I'll explain why. People who are middle income and lower income people who go to work and get raises, their raises are based on the CPI. So you have people who are working their tails off, paying taxes, doing everything right, but they're getting increases that are keeping them from actually making any money. In fact, they're losing purchasing power every single year. So somebody who works in a factory And they don't have to be middle income to work in a factory, but let's just say they're middle income people or lower income, they're going to get a raise that might be 1.5 to 2% when their cost of living increase is 10%. So every single year they're getting further behind. So no wonder there's problems and there's crime and there's, you know, broken families. This to me is one of the great tragedies that have happened in our country. The miscalculation and the misunderstanding of the consumer price index. And it's not just from the government's, you know, entitlement programs and their benefit programs, but it's in the private sector, raises are tied to this bogus statistic. And this is what's killing a lot of families.
All right. So I was trying to build up to this, but you went straight to it. So thank you for doing that. Because I share your outrage here. And if you look at, you're exactly right. You know, if you look at the cost of living is calculated by the Chapwood Index, you know, wages by no way, you know, keep up in terms of the same growth rate. So, and that's nominal wages, right? So real wage growth, and we've seen lots of charts of this, has been, you know, pretty meager, if not even just flat, you know, for decades now, while the real cost of living has, you know, far outpaced real wage growth. So you're right. It's just squeezing and squeezing and squeezing working families. It's a total tragedy, in my opinion. And just like the government, you know, it's in the interests, the bottom line interests of corporations to not have to raise your wages as or to raise your wages as little as possible for them going forward. Right. It's not fair, but you can understand the misincentive they have to use that. So, all right. So, you know, if that is reality, and I think, you know, anybody watching this who lives in the real world, Ed, right, you know, who buys food, who, you know, uses medical care, who drives a car, who has to afford a roof over their head, who has to educate their kids, they know that the real cost of living is not increasing less than 2% annually. They know it's much more than that. So I think they probably have a real gut resonance with just this topic. That, like, yeah, exactly, Ed, you're totally right. So here's a couple of questions. I guess the first one is, I get why the government is doing this, but why is the media not adopting indices like yours when it's reporting cost? Why is it sort of still universally embracing these bogus numbers? You know, you listen to any news, any business news show, you know, any nightly news when the new numbers come out, and they just report it totally unquestioned. How come at a minimum they're not using another index like yours to try to say, hey, you know what, maybe this index matches reality more?
Yeah, because most of the people in the media, and I've had a history with the media, most of the people there just repeat whatever is in a headline because they're very busy and they just want to repeat it and get it over with and move on. And it's a wonky subject. It's kind of difficult to explain to most people. So they just repeat it over and over again. And, you know, just like on your phone, you know, there'll be a news story out and you'll have five different pop-ups with the same story, the same exact story, because they just took it from the press release. So nobody wants to challenge the government and how they're calculating it, just like they do with the GDP numbers, the unemployment numbers, and the CPI numbers, as we're talking about. They just accept it on blind faith that the government is telling the truth. And, you know, but they should. They should absolutely challenge this. And they should look at the reason why these numbers are so wrong. They're not just a little bit wrong. It's not just a rounding error. They're tremendously incorrect. And the damage, as we said a second ago, you know, is insurmountable for most families.
Yeah. And I look, I get it. You know, the media is owned by, like, you know, all the, you know, most of the media is owned by like three or four corporations, right? There's this huge concentration in the media. We've talked about this in the past with experts like Matt Taibbi. And so maybe there's, you know, incentive for these corporate interests to parrot what the government's reporting. But, you know, most of the people, you know, who are behind the chairs and newsrooms, they're real people. You know, they have to pay bills and stuff like that. To me, it's akin to the weatherman saying, hey, everybody, today's going to be sunny and 70, but everybody can look out the window and see that it's 23 degrees and snowing. Right. It's that much of a disparity. So I don't know. I didn't necessarily expect you to have the answer there. But to me, it just it feels we're at that point of that vast a disparity from reality that it really just seems incredibly disingenuous. I'm not even going to say naive. I think you're maybe giving them the benefits of the doubt. I think it's very disingenuous. But let me ask the next big question, which is, how are folks surviving, right? I mean, you can only handle so many years of double-digit increase in your cost of living before you just don't have the income to make it. Right. We just talked about it. Incomes aren't growing nearly as fast. Right. You can only, and I mean, things just like healthcare alone, you know, if you're funding your own healthcare, you've been getting double digit increases now pretty much ever since the Affordable Healthcare Act was passed. So, Ed, how are people dealing with this?
Well, the first thing is understanding what the problem is. And once they understand it, then, you know, what do? They start to cut back and they become, you know, they become less of a consumer. They buy less. They certainly are not making as much because of the net result of the cost of living increase. So if they're making, you know, 5% on their portfolios and their cost of living is going up 8%, you know, they've just lost 3% purchasing power. And this eventually wears on them. So a lot of people cannot afford to retire. I mean, I've seen statistics all the time about how many people, what percentage of the people out there can afford to have a $5,000 unexpected bill. And it's like 70% of the people can't afford that. And so, you know, what I encourage people to do is get another job. I mean, they have to have an honest conversation about what is really happening with them. Now, it's different with the one percenters, because people who are the one percenters, and I'm going quote one percenters, these people earn money based on their productivity, but based on their abilities, because they're not getting a salary. They're out there making money and they're taking great risks. And those people can affect what they're making. So they can make more than 10% increase a year, or they can make 20% increase or outsized numbers. And they can also lose money. But that's the difference. And that's why you have such a disparity between those who have and those who don't have.
Yeah. And I'm going to describe that differently. So those one percenters, so you mentioned people's portfolios, right? The reality is that, you know, I think half or more than half of America didn't even own any stocks, right? They don't have a portfolio. And then of the financial assets that are out there, stocks, bonds, et cetera, it's something like 80% of them are owned by the top 10%. So those top percenters you're talking about, they own the vast majority of the financial assets. And we started this conversation talking about the financial asset price bubble that we've had here, right? And all the stimulus that's been going out, both monetary and fiscal. And really what that's doing is that is greatly advantageous to those folks who hold those financial assets, which are those top percenters, right? And everybody else, they don't have that tailwind at their back, right? So all they have is their income, right? So so sadly, what you're saying is, you know, hey, those people are in many ways, they're kind of just out of luck. And, you know, we went from a society where you could have a one paycheck earner and, you know, raise a middle-class family off of that. Now you have to have two paycheck earners, and it's increasingly tough to stay in the middle class along with that. So now you're basically saying you need two paycheck earners with multiple jobs to just try to stay afloat. And this is definitely a story of regression. And honestly, it feels so unfair to me. I was almost going to pick the word evil, but it just seems so unfair because right now the game board favors those top percenters so much and the big corporations, et cetera, at the expense of virtually everybody else who's just trying to get by.
It really is exactly what you just said. You said it much better than I did, by the way.
No worries. Well, let me get to my other question on this. And I've tossed this out to a few other guest experts we've had on this program in the past, but I think you're a particularly good one to pontificate on this, which is, why is there not an army of people storming Washington over this, right? Like I said earlier, it's the difference between 70 and sunny versus below freezing and snowing. Like, people can see it. It's not a complicated argument at this point. And particularly, as you mentioned, seniors, right? I mean, the Fed and its policies, right, bringing interest rates down as low as it has for as long as it has, it has killed, you know, both ends of the generational spectrum, right? It's helped contribute to the rise in asset prices. And so it's super hard for younger generations to build a foundation, right? Because housing is out of reach for them in many ways. It's hard for them to, you know, create savings that they get a return on and can build a portfolio, because there's just, you know, there's virtually nothing that return that you're getting on your savings. And similarly, on the other end of the spectrum, people used to retire, and then you would retire on the income off of your portfolio. You'd usually live off of a fixed income, right? You get into bonds and save for investments, which now yield low single digits on a good day, right? So, we've got 10,000 baby boomers hitting retirement age every day still. But these people, as you said earlier, they just can't afford to retire. One, because they're not getting any yield, but two, their cost of living is continuing to rise, right? So whatever is left over is just becoming less and less and less every year. So my question for you is, you know, how come the torches and pitchforks aren't out? And like, why isn't the AARP, you know, making this, why aren't they jumping on the end the Fed bandwagon and you know, arranging the Million Seniors March in Washington?
Well, they should be. But the reason is that it benefits both Democrats and Republicans to keep the inflation number low. And so, you know, a lot of people don't understand what's happening. They haven't taken the time to look at what happened in 1983 under Newt Gingrich, where he started to manipulate the CPI. And then again, the Boskin Commission, someone from Stanford in 1994, was asked to take a look at the cost of living increase or the CPI, and they reconfigured the CPI at that point. You know, there used to be 1,700 items that were calculated every single month, and they just took the raw data and used that, but the number got to 13.5% in 1981. So the government said, hey, we can't do this anymore. Let's change the way we calculate all of this. But if the number is low, it benefits Democrats, it benefits Republicans. But people need to understand it. That's why everyone should watch this conversation and understand that they should be out there with pitchforks and they should be having a march on Washington because of this. But it also isn't something that's in Washington's hands. You know, they can increase how much money people get with transfer payments, but they can't control the world economy. And the world economy is completely out of control in terms of costs going higher. That just the way they calculate it has changed. That's the biggest issue, is that the costs have continued to soar, but the way they calculate the increases has changed, as we've demonstrated here.
All right. So here's my additional concern, right? So you've talked about why the government calculates inflation the way that they do, and why it's in their interests and both sides of the aisle's interest to try to fool people that it's as low as it is. And of course, you know, your index is revealing what that true cost of living is. Here's my additional concern. We have two factors that I think are going to pour kerosene on this fire already. One is we have all this stimulus going out there into the world, right? And we are beginning to see, that making its way into commodity prices, right? And when commodity prices have been somewhat depressed for the past 10 years, but we're now seeing them pick up, and we've had a number of guests on this program argue for why commodity prices are likely going to have a pretty nice tailwind for the foreseeable future. And one big reason is because, you know, part of the stimulus that's going on is infrastructure spending, right? And you need actual real things in the world to build infrastructure, and that's happening worldwide now. So when commodity prices goes up, those are the base inputs for everything else, right? So you're going to see an increase in prices just because of that demand. We are also seeing in a lot of key commodities, we're seeing notable depletion, right? Where they're becoming harder to find, harder to extract. And so that scarcity also drives prices up. So it's kind of like a 1-2 punch to base input prices. So we've got all of the political machinations that you talked about going on, and we have these kind of real world constraints. So I don't see a lot of like relief on the real cost of living anytime soon. Do you share this concern?
Well, without question. I mean, it's a concern. You know, I didn't know about how tough it was to extract the commodities. That's something I was not aware of. But having said that, the infrastructure spending on top of the COVID stimulus, I mean, we're looking at another $2 trillion that they're talking about to do infrastructure repairs. And where is this money going to come from? It's all going to be a drain on what we, on the dollar. And as the dollar sinks, it's going to make more, you know, things more expensive to buy from outside the United States. You know, so if the dollar drops, you know, I think we import about 60% of what we use in this country. I think that's the number I heard most recently. So we're bringing in things from outside the United States. So if the dollar drops, it's going to cost us that much more to go out and acquire these things. I mean, there's nothing good about this discussion.
There's not. And you know, there is a class of people out there, and I'm going to show some of my personal bias here, but who, you know, they're in favor of programs like universal basic income. And what I think a lot of these people don't fully appreciate is this concept of sort of velocity of money. But when you give money directly to people, it gets spent usually, right? So it finds its way into the economy. And you know, a lot of the QE, the quantitative easing that the banks have been doing over the past bunch of years, hasn't been quote unquote inflationary, because a lot of that has sort of stayed on the balance sheets of a lot of big institutions. But when those dollars begin to get out in the real world, the velocity of money picks up, and that drives prices higher, right? So, you know, people might say, look, you know, I'm having trouble making my rent. If you, the government, give me an extra $1,000 a month, I can use that to pay my rent. And yes, you can. The problem is that rents in your area will quickly adjust for that extra money sloshing around. And all of a sudden, you know, your rent's going to be a lot higher. And even though you're getting $1,000 from the government more every month, it's, you know, immediately getting eaten up by that price increase. So net net, you're really not any better, right? So there's just not a lot of I think, relief, you know, that you and I are seeing on the horizon that suggests that cost of living is going to moderate at any point soon. So, Ed, look, as we wrap up here, and thanks so much for giving so much of your time here. You know, what policy changes would you like to see? You know, if we should be doing things differently here at a high level, what are some changes you'd like to see enforced?
Well, I'm very much a free market person. I'd like to see lower taxes versus higher taxes. And I'd like to see more money in the pockets of people so they can go out and spend it in a free market environment. And I'd like to see very, you know, much more reduced legislation. The regulations out there are only starting to build again. So I'm you know, very much a free market person. And those are the things that I'd like to see. I can't imagine that the government is going to very quickly or at any point start raising you know, how much money they give out in entitlement programs and transfer payments. I just can't imagine that. If anything, it's going to go lower. They're going to continue to try to make that argument that it's going to go lower, and that's not going to benefit anybody.
Okay. And then on the individual level, so we've got a lot of people watching this video, whether they were familiar with your index or not, I think, you know, they would most probably agree cost of living is higher than they would like it to be. And they're probably worried about where it's headed in the future. What advice would you have for those concerned investors who don't want to see their hard-earned nest eggs eroded away by the masked high rate of price inflation?
Yeah, well, have an honest conversation with your financial advisor about what your real cost of living increase is and figure out what your real return is based on your holdings. So if you have a historical rate of return of 8, and you know, use a standard, you know, well, whatever your standard deviation is, if you have a real rate of return of 8 and your cost of living increase is 8, you know, be honest with yourself, you're not making any money. And that's what you have to know. And you have to then take different risks in your portfolio by using alternative investments and using high yield bonds and taking a little bit more risk than having your money in fixed income where, you know, as you said earlier, your, you know, government numbers, you know, government bonds are yielding you about 1 to 1.5%. You can't do that. So you have to become better educated on how to manage money and how to manage risk in a portfolio. And that's how you're going to save your nest egg.
Well, that's a great point, and it's a great segue, because after we say goodbye to you here, Ed, we're going to talk with the Mike Preston, lead partner from New Harbor Financial, who's the financial advisory firm that comes on this program with me every week to talk about what the markets have done. So I want to put some words in your mouth and you tell me if you agree with them or not. But given your point there about risk, getting way back to your first answer about the asset price bubble we're in, the conundrum that so many of our viewers have is they are concerned about everything that you just mentioned, but they're very concerned about going out on the risk curve right now in the, you know, these high price stocks and high yield bonds and all that type of stuff, because they fear that there is a, you know, there's a price correction, probably a pretty sizable one that could happen given that we're at all time extreme levels of valuation, as you said earlier, right? So they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, right? They feel the pressure to reach for yield, but their brain is telling them, look, we might be in the last inning of this bubble here, at least in the near term, and I don't want to potentially risk losing half of my investment capital because I happen to be the greatest fool that put his chips on the table right before the big correction happened. So our big advice has always been, you know, work with your professional financial advisor, provided, of course, they understand all the issues and the risks that we've been talking about here, but really try to work with one who prioritizes risk mitigation, because if you go long in this market, given the fact that it's so at such high level of valuations, you want to have hedges in place to protect you in case indeed we do have a material correction. Would you agree with that?
Without question. And not just having hedges, you know, because, you know, that's limiting, you know, your downside, obviously, but it's also limiting your upside, depending on how you put the hedge on. But look at managed futures. Look at other types of asset classes that you're not that familiar with and learn about them, because that's how you're going to make money in a sideways to down market.
But great point. All right, here. So as we wrap this up, Ed, and again, thank you for sharing so much of your time. I really hope that you know, the world continues to look at alternatives to those published CPI numbers, alternatives like your index out there. And, you know, God, please, if you're in the media and watching this, you know, please just don't parrot, you know, the CPI blindly. Look at Ed's indices, look at Shadow Stats, John Williams, like he mentioned, and at least give your viewers, you know, a comparison between the two. But Ed, where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
I think go to chapwoodinvestments.com. And we have, we built some proprietary calculators in our investment forensics division. It's a section on our website where we give real honest analytical insight into portfolios. And we created 8 metrics on how to properly evaluate a portfolio, and something that we're really proud of.
All right, excellent. And when we edit this video, I'll put up the URL there so folks can go to it and check it out. Ed, really appreciate you sharing so much of your time with us. Look forward to having you on the program again.
Thank you very much.
All right, now we'll start chatting with the folks at New Harbor. Mike, I actually think it's just you today, right? John's out?
Just me today. Just
all right. Well, look, I don't know what you slipped Ed before the conversation there, but it seems like he just kind of put the ball up there on the tee for you and said, hey, look, what you really got to do is develop an honest sense of how exposed you are to the current cost of living. Go to Chapwood Index, find out what the cost of living is in your metropolitan area. And then look at your investment returns and kind of do the math and say, hey, look, what's the best way for me to invest to make sure that you know, my income and my investment returns are keeping up with my local cost of living. So in general, I guess I'll just give you a chance to just give any feedback to what Ed said, and then we can dive into what the markets have done over the past week.
I like what Ed said in the beginning. Make no mistake, this is a bubble. It's a giant bubble. You're not going to hear it from many people on Wall Street say the truth about this. Certainly you're not going to hear about it from the Fed or other central banks. We're in a giant bubble. You know, Ed talked about the trailing 12-month PE being, I think he said 36, and the forward PE being 23, he said. We like to look at the 10-year smooth price-to-earnings ratio and a lot of other indicators, too, which we think are even screaming louder that we're in a hyper-overvalued market. For instance, the cyclically adjusted price-earnings ratio invented by Professor Robert Shiller at Yale University is approaching 40 times earnings. That's a 10-year smooth for an average for inflation valuation figure. Other people like John Hussman do great work and then adjust that indicator for corporate profit margins, and that makes it look like we're closer to 50 times earnings. Or you can simply look at the Buffett indicator, the stock market capitalization divided by GDP. And that's approaching 200%. So price to sales ratio is at all-time highs by far. So just about every metric that you see is screaming overvaluation, and frankly has been for about at least three years, really. I mean, to us, we're in one big giant blow-off top that tried to top in January of 18, and there's been several successive tries since then. So I think Ed did a really good job of talking about how to properly manage or measure inflation. He talked about the reality of the current bubble market. You asked a good question about how to protect against a sudden down move, because if you hold high yield bonds, you might get 4% interest, which is the lowest interest on record for the class of high yield bonds, but you're very likely going to lose 40%.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the risk return there on high yield bonds is worth it personally.
That's the problem. You could do it with hedges, but you know, if you look back at charts of something like HYG or JNK, their ETFs that trade junk bonds, you'll see that they lost 40% in the last couple of downturns over the last 20 years. And trust me, it will happen again. So it's really hard. And we as money managers are charged with how to make some money for folks and, you know, and without taking that big drawdown. Our number one goal is to avoid big down capture. And you know, we'll be honest about it. If people are unhappy ever with, you know, their short-term performance with us, it's because they feel like they're missing out on this bubble. But honestly, there's no way to time this thing. You know, we're still making, good, respectable single-digit returns last year without much exposure to the market. We're still very lightly exposed to the market, only about 8% or so net, and that's in oil stocks presently. So, yeah, he said a lot of good things there, and he talked about other alternatives. We might suggest that you, consider buy rights on good sectors like oil. Buy a good oil stock or buy the sector, sell call options at the money against it. At least if you get a little bit of a down shock, those sectors won't, I don't think, participate as much as the S&P and the NASDAQ. And plus you'll be taking in some premium, essentially buying that sector lower. So essentially that's what we're doing, picking away at undervalued sectors, but there's not very many of them in this very, very late stage hyper overvalued market. It's a bubble.
Yeah. All right. Really well said, Mike. So, reflecting on what's happened since we filmed last week's video, right? I mean, the markets are just back in full melt-up, right? Congress passed the $1.9 trillion stimulus, right? Major indices are on fire. They've been up, 2% plus the past couple of days. We had a day there where Tesla was up 20% in a single day. Bitcoin has run from, correcting down to the low 40s. It's now back up near its all-time highs. I think it was at like 57,000 something last time I checked earlier today. Even GameStop, that's back up at $300 now or whatever, after having corrected way down into the 40s. Yep. So that whole madness is going back on. So it's crazy. And, I put this out in a tweet because this is one thing that just gives me a little bit of worry in my gut. Because Mike, I'm right there with you and with so many of the guests that we've had on this program. But David Tepper just came out and said, folks, excuse my language here, but he said he is balls to the wall bullish on stocks right now. And I normally, wouldn't give too much credence to those type of claims, but Tepper was the guy back in early 2010 who basically coined the term the Fed put, or at least said, hey, look, the Fed is going to have our backs going forward. They are going to have to print a bunch of new money to try to support the system here. And that's going to be very supportive of stocks. Everybody, you should go long. We're going to have one of the best investing decades of history in front of us. And he was right. He totally called that. So I can't discount him completely, given the success of his past calls. So it does worry me that he is saying, look, no matter whether you like it or not, stocks are going higher from here. And of course, David Hunter, who we had on a few months back, he's predicting a horrendous crash of up to 80%, but he was predicting a melt up beforehand. And he's been pretty active lately saying, yep, this is what I'm talking about. And it's not done. Things are going higher from here. So we may indeed see higher prices from here, even though it's hard to comprehend given how stretched the valuations you are, you know, in that list of data that you just mentioned there, Mike. So pretty head spinning at this point.
Yeah, nothing necessarily can, you know, will keep this market from going higher. It's possible. It would be silly to say it's not possible. If there's one thing that we learned in this business, it's humility. You know, anything's possible. But, you know, even David Hunter was saying that we might go 20% higher up to 4,500 on the S&P and then crash 80% from there down to 800 or 900. Well, you know, that's about 70% down from here and 80% down from there. Unless you think you can time this melt up, if it even happens, it's not worth it. It's not worth it.
Right, yeah. Right. There's that term.
It's hard.
Yeah, there's that term picking up nickels in front of the steamroller, right? I mean, at this point, if you're aggressively buying in because you think that there's a little bit more to be gained before a potential correction, hey, you might be right. But the downside risk is just so much higher than the upside at this point. It is like scrambling for pennies or nickels in front of a steamroller. It's just not worth risking your life over. So two quick things. One, just as a sign of how, unnatural today's market environment is, I want to put up this chart, which shows the yield of investment grade debt and the yield of the 10-year treasury. This chart may be a couple of days old, but it shows that the 10-year treasury yield is now higher than the average corporate bond, basically. And that, guys, that's just, it's just unnatural, right? It's like, snowing in the Sahara. The U.S. Treasury is supposed to be the safest instrument out there in the financial asset universe. And, right now the corporate bond index, which, you know, is comprised of all the different companies that are out there with all the risk that each of those business risk that each of those companies take on every day, that right now is being priced as a safer asset than a 10-year U.S. Treasury. So it just says that folks that are buying in at today's prices, whether it's stocks, whether it's bonds, are just not taking risk into account. So I want to pivot to that, to the story of taking risk into account, because that was something that Ed recommended. And of course, he's echoing lots of our past very brilliant guest experts on this program. And that's what it's the main reason why we bring you guys onto this program, Mike, is to help people track, you know, kind of where reality is as best we can see, given all the distortions that are in the world here. And if you don't mind, I'd like for you to tell a story, because, you guys have your own sort of model portfolio that you think is a wise allocation given today's reality. Now, you might have clients who say, hey, that's great, but I also want to take on additional risks. I'm comfortable taking on a little bit more risk than maybe your average client. And my understanding is you guys will say, hey, if that's what you want to do, absolutely, we can help you do that. And I know you've had clients, and you were telling me about one recently, who have said, you know what, like I'm seeing my friends make too much money, just kind of, you know, being long the full market. I want to go long. And you've sat down with them to have the conversation of, okay, we can do that for you if you want to, but let's just review the reasons why our model portfolio isn't long. And after you've kind of gone through all the fundamentals, they've changed their minds and said, oh, you know what? You're right. I really don't want to take on that kind of crazy risk right now. So is that true? And can you provide any additional context around that?
Sure. I mean, most of the time we're on the phone these days, we're spent educating people, either dealing with emotions or educating them about where we are. Because when you're in the middle of this bubble, it's nearly impossible to see it. You know, I mean, and I've been in this business since the late 90s, and this is the third bubble I've been through. First the tech bubble, then the housing bubble, then this one. This one is bigger. The amount of euphoria and fear of missing out is bigger than it was during the tech bubble. I saw it. I was there. I worked for a company called Payne Weber at the time, later became UBS. But so we're talking to people all the time. We're talking about the data. And yes, near term, the data evaluations doesn't mean anything about timing. And yes, we could go higher before a collapse. But make no mistake about it, the math says that we're going to have a drop in the market, a 50% drop in the market from here, or even if it's a little bit higher, would actually be the mildest correction ever from this set of conditions. So of course, it's psychologically difficult for clients and prospects. And we talk all day long about this. And essentially, central banks are waging a psychological type of war on people to try to make them feel uncomfortable. So yes, we'll educate them. We'll go through the data. People do want us to tell them what we think they should do. They want us to say it's okay to, you know, to take more risk. And we'll tell them where our model portfolio is. It's about 8% net long only. And that's in an undervalued sector, oil. And the reason is we don't think there's going to be any getting out of the way when we see a big drop. The first drop in the S&P is probably going to be relatively fast, 30%. That's what happened last March. Had we not seen the bailout of many trillions of dollars, we probably would have stayed there and moved lower. But history shows the first move down from these levels is 30% quickly. And then, of course, everyone's going to want to buy. And if it doesn't bounce right away, that's when you see the second third drop from there. Two one-third subsequent drops brings you down minus 50%. We think that's probably a minimum. But having said all that, we can help people take some of the pressure off themselves psychologically by taking little tiny strides into the market. We know options really well. We can pick strong sectors and undervalued sectors, things like oil and gas, pay good dividends, and then we could buy positions that aren't too large. We still don't want to take much a very large position. And then we could sell at the money calls against these positions, essentially hedging and bringing extra income into the account. I still think with these valuations, we're going to run into a situation where we have to adjust those hedges and scramble a little bit from time to time. But you know, when people work with us on this, they actually at least have a plan versus so much of Wall Street and so many advisors out there are just kind of saying, you know, put your money into a kind of an asset allocation and hold it for the long term. We have a plan no matter what happens, and that's what we can help people with.
Great. And that really talks to so many of the previous experts we've had on this program who say, you know, this is the most treacherous time, you know, in all of their professional experience for investors. And so you need to be nimble. And, you know, for most people don't have the time or the familiarity to be, you know, kind of daily market watchers and, you know, looking at what's happening on the macro level and kind of, you know, jumping in, jumping out as the conditions on the ground, you know, may dictate. And that's why working with a financial advisor who kind of gets the big picture, understands these risks, you know, you're relying on them for A, to be the full-time game watchers, right? The guys who are watching both the macro data, but also the tape every day, but are also, you know, assessing in real time the risk return of when to be in and when to be out. So anyways, as we say every week, highly recommend that you work with a financial advisor who understands everything that we've talked about here with Ed, that I've been talking about with Mike here. If you've got a good one, great, stick with them. They're worth their weight in gold. But if not, and if you haven't heard me say this before on previous programs, the guys at New Harbor, as a public service to the Peak Prosperity viewers, they offer a free consultation where they'll sit down with you, they'll hear about your personal financial situation, your goals, your risk tolerance, et cetera, and they'll tell you what they'll tell you what they think you should do. And this is completely free. There's no obligation to work with them. It's kind of one of these, like, why wouldn't you do this kind of things? So if you haven't done it yet, stick around to the end of this program. We tell you how to schedule one of those free consultations with them, and it only takes you like 15 seconds to set it up. With that being said, Mike, I think we'll wrap things up here. Maybe just a quick commentary about gold, because we talk about precious metals a lot on this podcast as a way to try to, you know, preserve your capital from this, you know, much higher inflation than the government is reporting. You know, the precious metals had sort of been weakening over the past, you know, 2 months or so. Gold had got from highs above 2000 down into the sort of mid 1600 range. But it has looked like it has hit a bottom and bounced a bit. What are you seeing?
Yeah, we've been looking at the 1680 to 1720 range for a while. A couple of weeks ago, gold was sitting on that support shelf at 1765. It looked like it wanted to break. Gold generally does break those support, you know, zones and kind of flushes weak hands out. We went pretty quickly down to the 1680, 1720 zone. And we're closing around 1720 today. I don't know, obviously, for sure, if we don't take one more stab down through that, but I'd be very comfortable buying in this zone, particularly for people that don't have any yet. You know, just go ahead and get some. And if you don't feel like you have enough and you want to add, I would be adding here. You know, at 1687 to 1720, this is a major area of support. It's a big pullback of about $400 from the high, almost a 20-something percent pullback of last August high. Gold versus silver, we're a little bit more ambivalent about whether people buy gold versus silver here. The ratio of gold to silver or silver to gold is back around 63 or 65 to 1. It had gone as high as 123 to 1 last summer, and we were pounding the table on silver. But we'd buy either, and you know, probably just buy some gold here if you don't have any or if you want some more. We still like gold miners, and it's a core position for us. We do have them hedged just in case we get one more flush lower, but the miners look very good here too.
All right, thanks. And I was actually on a program earlier today with Mike Maloney and Jeff Clark from goldsilver.com. And Mike was commenting that he thought today's prices are actually a very attractive entry point, as you said. And Jeff was saying that the mining complex is actually looking pretty attractively priced right now. So just some additional perspective on that. All right, so in wrapping things up here really quickly, folks, thanks for watching. If you haven't yet, please take a second and subscribe to this channel. The subscribe button's right down there under the like button. Subscribe, click the little bell icon next to it. That way you'll get alerted when the next one of these videos go out, so you won't have to hunt for it on yourself. While you're down there, of course, click that like button too. It does help in how successfully these videos get shared across the internet. If you are interested in finding out who are going to be our future guests on this program, and we've got, I think, already like four amazing guests lined up for the next coming 4 weeks, you'll find that out by subscribing to my Twitter feed at Menlo Bear. So if you follow me on Twitter, I give an early release of new guests that we're having on here, but I also listen to your suggestions for new guests as well. So if you've got ideas, please share them with me there. And then as we talked about earlier, if you have yet to have one of those free consultations with Mike and the team at New Harbor, then just stick around at the end of this video. We'll tell you how to do that. But, you know, given where we are in this story, given everything that, Ed contributed today from the cost of living standpoint as well, boy, you know, this is the time to have a plan. If you're just winging it, that is highly likely, you know, the old saying, failure to have a plan is failing to plan means planning to fail. So, you know, at least get a working plan in place. And if you don't already have a great financial advisor in place to do that, consider talking to Mike and the team there at New Harbor. All right. And with that, Mike, whatever the markets do next from here, we'll be tracking it live on these weekly programs. I'll see you next week.
I know that I was muted. We'll be here. Thank you very much, Adam. We'll see you next week.
If you'd like to schedule a consultation with the financial advisors at New Harbor Financial, simply go to greylockpeak.com. These consultations are completely free and there are no strings attached. The good folks at New Harbor will simply answer any questions you have about your investment goals or your portfolio and give you their best advice given the latest market outlook. They're willing to do this because they care about protecting people's wealth and because Peak Prosperity has connected them with so many thoughtful investors just like you over the past decade. Chris and I started doing this because so many people have approached us in frustration and are looking for a solution because they're feeling out of alignment or just downright ridiculed by the standard sort of financial advisors who have been managing their money. You know the type, the kind that just pushes all of your money into the market, scoffs at the idea of owning gold, and when you bring up concerns about the market's sky-high valuations, they say, "Don't worry, the market's always going to take care of you." For many of the reasons discussed in today's video, we think this is one of the most challenging and treacherous times in history for investing, which is why we strongly believe that today's investors are best served working in partnership with a conscientious professional advisor who understands the risks in play. Now, we're agnostic which professional advisor you'll work with, just as long as they're good. If you're already working with one, that's fantastic. Stick with them. But if you aren't, or you're having trouble finding one you respect or trust, then consider talking to John and Mike and the team at New Harbor. And for those about to ask, yes, there's a business relationship between Peak Prosperity and New Harbor, which we had to put in place to make sure that everything is handled according to SEC regulations. All the details on this are clearly provided on the greylockpeak.com website. Also, it's important to note that New Harbor is able to work with U.S. citizens, green card holders, and those with existing assets in the USA. But for regulatory reasons, they aren't able to take on non-U.S. clients. All right. With all that said, if you'd like some insight and guidance on how to protect your wealth during this unprecedented time in the markets, go to greylockpeak.com to schedule your free consultation with the good folks at New Harbor. Thanks for watching.